become your masters of war. You that build the big guns, you that build the death planes, you that build all the bombs, you that hide behind walls, you that hide behind disks. I just want you to know I can read through your mask. You that never done nothing but build to destroy. You play with my world like it's your own little toy. You put a gun in my hand and you hide from my eyes. Then you turn and run, father, when the fast bullets fly.
That's Dylan with his classic Masters of War. This is Lead Stories. I'm Utrice Lead, and I had an inkling that it was possible today that we will all be talking about the same thing. honoring Dick Gregory. But I decided I would prepare an in-case program, which is equally important to talk about, and that's what we'll do today. I did announce that we pick up that conversation. It still is a very important program to discuss, you know, just what is going on in the society that people just can't see. I mean, they just can't see it. They refuse to see it. These are intentionally ignorant people. And unfortunately, they have the reins of power in their hands. And yes, I'm talking about you, Donald Trump, and your minions. But I thought I would switch to the related subject of Trump's second wind. And we see it in his, well, people around him preparing him to be a master of war. Some months ago, I talked about Mr. McMaster, who was his military person, his military advisor, and I dissected him, and I was so on point, it's not even funny. I'm going to find that and read you my analysis. This was just on him. He just had an interview, and I excerpted a sizable portion of the interview and totally psychoanalyzed this man. And the one thing I did say was he wants a star. He wants a new star badly. And he will do anything to get it. And I think that caused a great deal of dissension within the ranks in the White House. He's a very ambitious man, views himself as an intellectual, which he is not. And he really thinks that this is the time for him to accomplish the goal. The goal is to get that star and put it in, on his chest or his lapel and become the general of the United States. And when you have people like that around you who are motivated mostly by defining themselves in the exploits of war, then you'll always have war. And war and the exploits of war feed into the economy. That's what we want. We want a vibrant economy utilizing other people's sons and daughters. It's okay if they die. It's just, you know, a casualty. And we move on. We bow our heads reverentially. Once every year, when we honor the soldiers and those who died for the country. Well, we see more and more, they're not dying for the country. They're dying for other people's ambitions. They're dying to keep an economy going. Because when you look at the people talking, no principles whatsoever, they're not interested in the people here. But they do understand that if they mean to exemplify themselves, they will concoct a war. And it will go down in history. It will get some coverage. And it will eventually become a montage that they will hang on their wall. But most importantly, there's no reason to believe that these folks are any more compassionate than they have been in all of their lives, outside of the military or inside of it. So President Donald Trump yesterday announced to soldiers at the Joint Base Henderson Hall at Arlington, Virginia, that the U.S. military policy and tactics in Afghanistan and South Asia have been revised. He did not spell out the changes he has made, what the revisions are, if any, saying only that it's about killing terrorists. But what he's saying is, we'll use your sons and your daughters to kill terrorists so that I could be great. It's not let's make America great again. Let's make me something great. So, and tonight, by the way, he appears again. It's like his first rally since the election. He's going back to the old pomposity, believing that he's fit. He knows how to do this, and he is, in fact, ironically, legally a commander-in-chief. But this is not a commander-in-chief speech. This is a straight-out political rally, hoping to recoup something that is left from his frazzled, nascent presidency. So he'll be speaking in Phoenix tonight, and he'll tell people how he plans to make America great again. He has been served notice, though, that a whole bunch of people don't think it's great. And a whole bunch of people don't want him there because they're convinced with him at the helm, America will not achieve greatness. It will just build more bombs and drop them in different places, blow up as many cities and towns, kill as many people as possible. It's a traditional way. So he's reviving that formula for American greatness tonight. I want to share with you his speech of last night. He's talking to soldiers, and he's trying to give them a quick overview of what they're in for. So here's President Trump delivering the great news about America at the Joint Base Meyer-Henderson Hall in Arlington, Virginia. Enjoy.
Secretary of State Tillerson, members of the cabinet, General Dunford, Deputy Secretary Shanahan, and Colonel Duggan. Most especially, thank you to the men and women of Fort Myer and every member of the United States military at home and abroad. We send our thoughts and prayers to the families of our brave sailors who were injured and lost after a tragic collision at sea, as well as to those conducting the search and recovery efforts. I am here tonight to lay out our path forward in Afghanistan and South Asia. But before I provide the details of our new strategy, I want to say a few words to the service members here with us tonight. to those watching from their posts, and to all Americans listening at home. Since the founding of our republic, our country has produced a special class of heroes whose selflessness, courage, and resolve is unmatched in human history. American patriots from every generation have given their last breath on the battlefield for our nation and for our freedom. Through their lives, and though their lives were cut short, in their deeds they achieved total immortality. By following the heroic example of those who fought to preserve our republic, we can find the inspiration our country needs to unify, to heal, and to remain one nation under God. The men and women of our military operate as one team with one shared mission and one shared sense of purpose. They transcend every line of race, ethnicity, creed, and color to serve together and sacrifice together in absolutely perfect cohesion. That is because all service members are brothers and sisters. They're all part of the same family. It's called the American family. They take the same oath, fight for the same flag, and live according to the same law. They are bound together by common purpose, mutual trust, and selfless devotion to our nation and to each other. The soldier understands what we as a nation too often forget, that a wound inflicted upon a single member of our community is a wound inflicted upon us all. When one part of America hurts, we all hurt. And when one citizen suffers an injustice, we all suffer together. Loyalty to our nation demands loyalty to one another. Love for America requires love for all of its people. When we open our hearts to patriotism, there is no room for prejudice, no place for bigotry, and no tolerance for hate. The young men and women we send to fight our wars abroad deserve to return to a country that is not at war with itself at home. We cannot remain a force for peace in the world if we are not at peace with each other. As we send our bravest to defeat our enemies overseas, and we will always win, let us find the courage to heal our divisions within. Let us make a simple promise to the men and women we ask to fight in our name, that when they return home from battle, they will find a country that has renewed the sacred bonds of love and loyalty that unite us together as one. Thanks to the vigilance and skill of the American military and of our many allies throughout the world, horrors on the scale of September 11th, and nobody can ever forget that, have not been repeated on our shores. But we must acknowledge the reality I am here to talk about tonight, that nearly 16 years after September 11th attacks, after the extraordinary sacrifice of blood and treasure, the American people are weary of war without victory. Nowhere is this more evident than with the war in Afghanistan, the longest war in American history, 17 years. I share the American people's frustration. I also share their frustration over a foreign policy that has spent too much time, energy, money, and most importantly, lives, trying to rebuild countries in our own image instead of pursuing our security interests above all other considerations. That is why, shortly after my inauguration, I directed Secretary of Defense Mattis and my national security team to undertake a comprehensive review of all strategic options in Afghanistan and South Asia. My original instinct was to pull out, and historically, I like following my instincts. But all my life, I've heard that decisions are much different when you sit behind the desk in the Oval Office. In other words, when you're President of the United States. So I studied Afghanistan in great detail and from every conceivable angle. After many meetings over many months, we held our final meeting last Friday at Camp David with my cabinet and generals to complete our strategy. I arrived at three fundamental conclusions about America's core interests in Afghanistan. First, our nation must seek an honorable and enduring outcome worthy of the tremendous sacrifices that have been made, especially the sacrifices of lives. The men and women who serve our nation in combat deserve a plan for victory. They deserve the tools they need and the trust they have earned to fight and to win. Second, the consequences of a rapid exit are both predictable and unacceptable. 9/11, the worst terrorist attack in our history, was planned and directed from Afghanistan because that country was ruled by a government that gave comfort and shelter to terrorists. A hasty withdrawal would create a vacuum that terrorists, including ISIS and Al-Qaeda, would instantly fill, just as happened before September 11th. And as we know, in 2011, America hastily and mistakenly withdrew from Iraq. As a result, our hard-won gains slipped back into the hands of terrorist enemies. Our soldiers watched as cities they had fought for and bled to liberate and won were occupied by a terrorist group called ISIS. The vacuum we created by leaving too soon gave safe haven for ISIS to spread, to grow, recruit, and launch attacks. We cannot repeat in Afghanistan the mistake our leaders made in Iraq. Third and finally, I concluded that the security threats we face in Afghanistan and the broader region are immense. Today, 20 U.S.-designated foreign terrorist organizations are active in Afghanistan and Pakistan, the highest concentration in any region, anywhere in the world. For its part, Pakistan often gives safe haven to agents of chaos, violence, and terror. The threat is worse because Pakistan and India are two nuclear-armed states whose tense relations threaten to spiral into conflict, and that could happen. No one denies that we have inherited a challenging and troubling situation in Afghanistan and South Asia, but we do not have the luxury of going back in time and making different or better decisions. When I became president, I was given a bad and very complex hand, but I fully knew what I was getting into, big and intricate problems. But one way or another, these problems will be solved. I'm a problem solver. And in the end, we will win. We must address the reality of the world as it exists right now, the threats we face, and the confronting of all of the problems of today, an extremely predictable consequences of a hasty withdrawal. We need look no further than last week's vile, vicious attack in Barcelona to understand that terror groups will stop at nothing to commit the mass murder of innocent men, women, and children. You saw it for yourself. Horrible. As I outlined in my speech in Saudi Arabia 3 months ago, America and our partners are committed to stripping terrorists of their territory, cutting off their funding, and exposing the false allure of their evil ideology. Terrorists who slaughter innocent people will find no glory in this life or the next. They are nothing but thugs and criminals and predators and, that's right, losers. Working alongside our allies, we will break their will, dry up their recruitment, keep them from crossing our borders, and yes, we will defeat them, and we will defeat them handily. In Afghanistan and Pakistan, America's interests are clear. We must stop the resurgence of safe havens that enable terrorists to threaten America, and we must prevent nuclear weapons and materials from coming into the hands of terrorists and being used against us or anywhere in the world, for that matter. But to prosecute this war, we will learn from history. As a result of our comprehensive review, American strategy in Afghanistan and South Asia will change dramatically in the following ways. A core pillar of our new strategy is a shift from a time-based approach to one based on conditions. I've said it many times, how counterproductive it is for the United States to announce in advance the dates we intend to begin or end military options. We will not talk about numbers of troops or our plans for further military activities. Conditions on the ground, not arbitrary timetables, will guide our strategy from now on. America's enemies must never know our plans or believe they can wait us out. I will not say when we are going to attack, but attack we will. Another fundamental pillar of our new strategy is the integration of all instruments of American power, diplomatic, economic, and military, toward a successful outcome. Someday, after an effective military effort, perhaps it will be possible to have a political settlement that includes elements of the Taliban in Afghanistan. But nobody knows if or when that will ever happen. America will continue its support for the Afghan government and the Afghan military as they confront the Taliban in the field. Ultimately, it is up to the people of Afghanistan to take ownership of their future, to govern their society, and to achieve an everlasting peace. We are a partner and a friend, but we will not dictate to the Afghan people how to live or how to govern their own complex society. We are not nation building again. We are killing terrorists. The next pillar of our new strategy is to change the approach and how to deal with Pakistan. We can no longer be silent about Pakistan's safe havens for terrorist organizations, the Taliban, and other groups that pose a threat to the region and beyond. Pakistan has much to gain from partnering with our effort in Afghanistan. It has much to lose by continuing to harbor criminals and terrorists. In the past, Pakistan has been a valued partner. Our militaries have worked together against common enemies. The Pakistani people have suffered greatly from terrorism and extremism. We recognize those contributions and those sacrifices. But Pakistan has also sheltered the same organizations that try every single day to kill our people. We have been paying Pakistan billions and billions of dollars. At the same time, they are housing the very terrorists that we are fighting. But that will have to change, and that will change immediately. No partnership can survive a country's harboring of militants and terrorists who target U.S. service members and officials. It is time for Pakistan to demonstrate its commitment to civilization, order, and to peace. Another critical part of the South Asia strategy for America is to further develop its strategic partnership with India, the world's largest democracy and a key security and economic partner of the United States. We appreciate India's important contributions to stability in Afghanistan, but India makes billions of dollars in trade with the United States, and we want them to help us more with Afghanistan, especially in the area of economic assistance and development. We are committed to pursuing our shared objectives for peace and security in South Asia and the broader Indo-Pacific region. Finally, my administration will ensure that you, the brave defenders of the American people, will have the necessary tools and rules of engagement to make this strategy work and work effectively and work quickly. I have already lifted restrictions the previous administration placed on our warfighters that prevented the Secretary of Defense and our commanders in the field from fully and swiftly waging battle against the enemy. Micromanagement from Washington, D.C. does not win battles. They are one in the field, drawing upon the judgment and expertise of wartime commanders and frontline soldiers, acting in real time with real authority and with a clear mission to defeat the enemy. That's why we will also expand authority for American armed forces to target the terrorist and criminal networks that sow violence and chaos throughout Afghanistan. These killers need to know they have nowhere to hide, that no place is beyond the reach of American might and American arms. Retribution will be fast and powerful. As we lift restrictions and expand authorities in the field, we are already seeing dramatic results in the campaign to defeat ISIS, including the liberation of Mosul in Iraq. Since my inauguration, we have achieved record-breaking success in that regard. We will also maximize sanctions and other financial and law enforcement actions against these networks to eliminate their ability to export terror. When America commits its warriors to battle, we must ensure they have every weapon to apply swift, decisive, and overwhelming force. Our troops will fight to win. We will fight to win. From now on, victory will have a clear definition. Attacking our enemies, obliterating ISIS, crushing Al-Qaeda, preventing the Taliban from taking over Afghanistan, and stopping mass terror attacks against America before they emerge. We will ask our NATO allies and global partners to support our new strategy with additional troop and funding increases in line with our own. We are confident they will. Since taking office, I have made clear that our allies and partners must contribute much more money to our collective defense, and they have done so. In this struggle, the heaviest burden will continue to be borne by the good people of Afghanistan and their courageous armed forces. As the Prime Minister of Afghanistan has promised, we are going to participate in economic development to help defray the cost of this war to us. Afghanistan is fighting to defend and secure their country against the same enemies who threaten us. The stronger the Afghan security forces become, the less we will have to do. Afghans will secure and build their own nation and define their own future. We want them to succeed. but we will no longer use American military might to construct democracies in faraway lands or try to rebuild other countries in our own image. Those days are now over. Instead, we will work with allies and partners to protect our shared interests. We are not asking others to change their way of life, but to pursue common goals that allow our children to live better and safer lives. This principled realism will guide our decisions moving forward. Military power alone will not bring peace to Afghanistan or stop the terrorist threat arising in that country. But strategically applied force aims to create the conditions for a political process to achieve a lasting peace. America will work with the Afghan government as long as we see determination and progress. However, our commitment is not unlimited, and our support is not a blank check. The government of Afghanistan must carry their share of the military, political, and economic burden. The American people expect to see real reforms, real progress, and real results. Our patience is not unlimited. We will keep our eyes wide open. In abiding by the oath I took on January 20th, I will remain steadfast in protecting American lives and American interests. In this effort, we will make common cause with any nation that chooses to stand and fight alongside us against this global threat. Terrorists, take heed. America will never let up until you are dealt a lasting defeat. Under my administration, many billions of dollars more is being spent on our military. And this includes vast amounts being spent on our nuclear arsenal and missile defense. In every generation, we have faced down evil, and we have always prevailed. We prevailed because we know who we are and what we are fighting for. Not far from where we are gathered tonight, hundreds of thousands of America's greatest patriots lay in eternal rest at Arlington National Cemetery. There is more courage, sacrifice, and love in those hallowed grounds than in any other spot on the face of the earth. Many of those who have fought and died in Afghanistan enlisted in the months after September 11th, 2001. They volunteered for a simple reason. They loved America, and they were determined to protect her. Now we must secure the cause for which they gave their lives. We must unite to defend America from its enemies abroad. We must restore the bonds of loyalty among our citizens at home. And we must achieve an honorable and enduring outcome worthy of the enormous price that so many have paid. Our actions, and in months to come, all of them, will honor the sacrifice of every fallen hero, every family who lost a loved one, and every wounded warrior who shed their blood in defense of our great nation. With our resolve, we will ensure that your service and that your families will bring about the defeat of our enemies and the arrival of peace. We will push onward to victory with power in our hearts, courage in our souls, and everlasting pride in each and every one of you. Thank you. May God bless our military, and may God bless the United States of America. Thank you very much. Thank you.
Wow. A very stirring speech indeed. Except we're hearing it from our head of state, who has never been in the military. He dodged duty 5 separate times. None of his children is in the military, including his 2 sons.
But he knows very well what the military is supposed to do. And he's so proud of the military that he made it a point to exempt himself from service. You know, I wonder sometimes whether people in office at this level, even though, of course, the speeches are written for them, and they just have to rehearse them and read them in private and then look very, very powerful behind a podium. But do they really understand that they're lying? Do they really think about what they are reading? In many ways, a made-up history. It is Afghanistan now that we must punish resolutely. There is no mention of massive errors on the part of the United States, not just in Afghanistan, but all over the world. This is not a one-party sin committed by one country or two or three. When you look at the history of world wars, and you see how they go from a small thing to a huge thing, invariably, you will find out who the guilty party is. Who starts these things? Over what? The president creates an alternative history and believes it, or he at least wants us to believe it. But I'm not biting. I'm not biting any of this. The United States has not, well, of course, Trump places blame in the way he chooses to admit some portion of responsibility. It, of course, it's Obama's fault. We've discussed his obsession with Obama. And because of this obsession, he chooses to rewrite history. The United States is never responsible for anything but honoring the faithful soldiers and the universal call for freedom and equality and all the things that he has not done since he's been in office. And the many things that the generals themselves, who are, quote, advising this president, they see it's a great opportunity for a nice little war. Wars invigorate things. And people tend to look the other way when we're talking all this patriotic stuff. Except many of the soldiers who are in their graves were denied opportunities, but went to war because they were commanded to. Many of the soldiers going to war, they already know where they're going to get them. They'll get them in black neighborhoods, and they'll get them in Latino neighborhoods, and they'll get them in poor white neighborhoods. And they'll be cannon fodder. And we will be told when they are dead that they helped to save America. Did we hear any reference to historical facts here? What is the historical relationship between Afghanistan and Pakistan and other countries in the region to the United States? What did the United States do in that region that so damaged the possibility for those specific countries to come fully into their own? Look at the history. Now he's saying to these countries, don't look to us. We will help you if we can, but you're on your own. And worse, we're coming after you. He's talking about the expansion of the nuclear program and so forth. But, you know, it's so amazing that the obvious always escapes the government. If you're telling people ahead of time, we're coming for you, and we have nuclear power, we have filled out our supply of what we would need militarily to conquer you, aren't you also telling them to get prepared? Aren't you also warning them? Aren't you also encouraging war by using language like this? He has not mentioned the dates that he talked to this prime minister or that prime minister or president. The speech is made as a kind of a threat. These are threats to other countries. And if it is okay for you to attack whenever you feel like it, wherever you feel like it, and as viciously as you feel like it, why should they just sit there and wait to be targets? It's like this thing with the wall. Great, you build a wall. And your simplistic brain tells you you are keeping people out. It never dawns on you that you're also walling yourself in. I mean, it's just, you marvel that with all of this fancy stuff that you got to fight with and demonstrate your power and your will, your world power, simple facts of logic totally escape you. Every time it does you in. Oh, we're going to build a wall. Okay. So they'll watch you build your wall. And they'll laugh. Because you're also containing yourself. You're walling yourself in. And you're selling the idea to people that this will keep the enemy out. Isn't that stupid on its face? It's stupid. But stupidity is one of the shining talents that Donald Trump has. But he's good. He's good at trying to make a sale. And that requires us to be as dumb as he is, to believe him. There is not one reference in that whole speech that said we fouled up at any time. It's just people out of nowhere started attacking us and people just doing some really crazy stuff. And now we have to defend ourselves using your sons and your daughters and raising your taxes so that we could make America great again. And people are buying it. This, America says, is leadership. The media, after the speech, went practically crazy about the new Donald Trump. This isn't Donald Trump can't write a speech. He can't write a cogent sentence, a cogent paragraph. In fact, I went through the first paragraph of his speech. There are about 8 errors in there. And this is after somebody really qualified has written it. Grammatical errors, spelling errors, punctuation errors. So I'm not under any illusion that this stuff comes from the minds of highly, highly educated people. No, This message came from the minds of ambitious generals. He has been captured. Donald Trump is a captive president. He is now to do what they tell him to do. He has no experience at all in this matter, and he's getting, quote, advice from all the wrong places. Why would he, right after the calamity that we really ought to be concerned about, the calamities that are occurring within our borders? That poses a greater threat than anything else at this moment. In your White House, you have the greatest division in history, and you can't fix that. You can't fix the divisions in your own house. That's not Obama. As I said very early on, you create chaos. You're most comfortable creating chaos, and the kind of chaos you can't fix. Because, you know, he's pointing to the trouble in Afghanistan, the trouble in Pakistan, the trouble here, the trouble there. He does not have a cogent plan. Certainly not a plan that looks down the road two or three centuries. You know, that's the kind of planning you ought to do. Because you know you're going to create that kind of damage that will take centuries to fix. But it doesn't enter your mind or the minds of your generals who want a quick start. McMaster wants to be seen as a military genius. Yeah. And you know he's not well loved among people who have much more experience than he does. Their approach is, let's create a climate. Let's work hard at creating a climate where we can kind of sort things out. McMaster says, let's pulverize them. That would solve it. We will blast them to kingdom come. That will solve it. And I'll get my star, and I'll get my name on a war, to name a war after me, the McMaster invasion, whatever. But he'll feel really good. At a time when this country's resources are dangerously low, at a time that we should think strategically, which means beyond the moment, beyond the excitement of going to war in your own time, with possibly your own name affixed to it. This guy is on a high for war. And as I repeat, Donald Trump has never been to war. He's never been in the Army. He's never been in the Navy or the Air Force. He took great care to not involve himself in the military under any conditions. And there he is, sounding like a patriot, with the speechwriter committing 8 errors in the first paragraph. We have to, as citizens, because, you know, it's always the people. They come and make these patriotic speeches, and people applaud. And if you were to walk up to anyone applauding, say, do you have a son or a daughter here? Yes, my boy is right over there. Okay. You know, he's going to be dead in a month. See what the attitude is then. See whether parents or husbands or wives or children would like the idea that for no good reason right now, the president has not made a convincing argument, listening to this drivel, as to exactly why war is necessary. And even if he thought so, this was the wrong arena for it. What, you think the rest of the world doesn't have, they don't have TVs? I could listen to you say that, yeah, we're coming. We're not going to tell you when, but we're coming for you. And not expect them to head you off at the pass. They're ready. They are ready. You know, he's talking about tanks, and he's talking about a type of warfare that they have never waged. The wars that they have been waging are asymmetrical. You see a guy walking down the street with a knapsack, and boom, half a block is gone. How are you going to respond to that on a mass scale? You're still stuck in the other world. The world of warfare has changed. You and all of your tanks can't get to the people who are committing these acts of war arbitrarily and with great devastation. What are you going to do? You're going to search everybody with a knapsack and call it war? So don't talk nonsense to people because you can. And because you assume that people no longer have brains. Or because you need something monumental to restore your vapid presidency. And that all these military people are creating the climate of militancy at a level we haven't seen in a while. So to give them a sense of purpose, you invent a war. When you have a hammer, or when you think you're a hammer, everything looks like a nail. But we will find out. Vietnam should have taught the United States the only lesson it would ever need in life. Don't assume people are going to sit there and take this kind of abuse. Now, that is not to say that smaller countries also pose a threat. But even then, we have to ask the question, what is the relationship between us and these conditions that we have created? Why don't your military arsenal, why don't you get a solid assessment of how things are unfolding? Why are they unfolding? What's our role in it? How could we fix this before it truly blows open? That has never been really the concern of the military. That has been the concern of the diplomats. And people like Trump see them as two separate things. The ideal is to get the diplomatic part of it, the equation, get it going, get it really vigorous. And there's where you get to form coalitions with other nations to say, look, this is a situation, it is bad, it's going to get worse, and we are all going to be affected. What can we do to avoid this? And if truly it comes to war, then at least you have made a sincere effort to avoid it. And you have the same racist attitudes, thinking like a little nation someplace, what damage could they do? how much of a threat could they be? I mean, and you have direct evidence in front of you. Well, we stop here today. What I want to do is anticipate tomorrow, and we'll put it all together. It is important that we understand that what's going on in the mind, not of just the president, what's going on in systems of power. Like I said, we should all remember the same guy telling all of this to us today, yesterday, avoided military service 5 times. Obama was not in the military, and Mr. Clinton never, ever went into the military. So they have entirely different ideas when it comes to them. But, you know, they become instantly commander-in-chief, and here we are listening to this guy tell us all this crap. So we listen tomorrow to that speech and comment on it. Time kind of went pretty fast, but I wanted especially to have you hear this speech. I'm sure you might have gotten snippets of it already. But when you slow down and you listen as opposed to hearing, hearing is reflexive, but listening is a cognitive process. He's already said today, we're going to war. I don't know if you got that. He has declared war. And he sold it using patriotism. American patriotism. We should be happy to support this country going to war. We should not question the motives of those who made the decisions to go to war. Therefore, we are to be assumed to agree that, yes, it's reasonable. It's a reasonable argument. And that's where the resistance ought to connect and tell this country now, you don't know what's ahead. Stop the speechifying and get down to the nitty-gritty. That's how people talk when they intend to send your sons and daughters to war, and you. All righty. So I want to thank you for listening. We will hear, because he's going to be out in Phoenix tonight on this political rally, reviving his political career, and he's telling us at our possible expense in more ways than one. All right. Thanks a lot for listening, as I said. Really pay attention to these things. They sound harmless because we're not thinking. We're reacting to words. But when you think about these things, you see exactly what they're saying. And this was a very significant moment. Stay tuned. What's coming up next? I'm beginning to question. I normally have my list in front of me. Infectious myth, of course, with David Crow. Thank you for that. Stay tuned for it. The infectious myth with David Crow. And we'll see each other tomorrow. Bye-bye.
You've thrown the worst fear.